Welcome, listeners, to day two of the Civilians Read podcast. As we left it off yesterday, no one has yet been voted off, but our civilian panelists have given their opening pitches for their books, and we also started getting into some of the more nitty-gritty questions concerning these books here. So the way we're going to start today is with a 30-second pitch, so they're getting half the time from yesterday, once again, to try and sell their books. This is really going to be the last time they just have free time to talk about their book. So this is their last plea to their fellow panelists before the voting starts at the end of today's show. So I'll do some introductions as we go around and have our civilians do their pitches. Yesterday, Ashley put hers off, and so we're going to start down at that end today with Ashley Gardner, who is representing Douglas Copeland's Generation X, and her 30-second pitch will start now.
Okay, so I think that a lot of Canadian literature is in immigration stories and people that have just come to Canada and are learning about Canada. And what I find so interesting about Generation X is that it's an expat story. There's Canadians that are in another country, a country quite similar to ours, but I think that that's where you really kind of see a sense of Canadianness that starts to appear is when you are somewhere else. And there were definite notes of that when someone had a Hudson's Bay blanket or things like that. So I think that that's an interesting part of Generation X.
Ding! There's the first bell noise of the Civilians Read podcast series. Okay, next up we have Aaron Balser. Aaron is arguing for Waste and Choi's The Jade Peony, which was originally published in 1995, I believe. All right, so go ahead, Aaron.
Okay, so one of the things in the book that I didn't talk about with my first pitch was just how timeless these themes in this book are. I mean, Ashley just did say that the immigration story is a powerful story, but it is a very Canadian story, and the ideas of identity, it's stuff people are still struggling with today. So even though it takes place in 1930s, 1940s, Vancouver, and was published in 1995, here we are in 2010, and it still is relevant.
Oh, see, you rushed it because my hand signals were inconsistent due to some pen dropping. So that was a host failure right there. Next up, we have Sarah Labrie, who is our panelist for Marina Endicott's Good to a Fault, and she'll have 30 seconds starting now.
Good to a Fault encompasses all the best things of all of the Canada Reads titles. Like Fall on Your Knees, it challenges the composition of a family. It navigates the development of identity that's explored in The Mapping in Nikolsky. It massages the otherness that defines The Jade Peony, exploring what happens to people who begin their life afresh in new surroundings. And Clara's frustration with her existence mirrors the railing against futility that permeates Generation X. If you read this book, you don't even have to read any of the others.
Whoa! So, Good to a Fault bites back. Okay, our fourth pitch today comes from Natalie St. Pierre, who is representing Anne-Marie MacDonald's Fall on Your Knees. Go ahead, Natalie.
Fall on Your Knees has war, accidental drowning, attempted murder, young love, subtle humor, alienation and deception, sacrifice and redemption, despair and finally hope, sex, drugs, and even a little rock and roll. Contrary to what Aaron said yesterday, it offers what I think is a little seen glimpse of the diversity of experience in early 20th century Atlantic Canada. The Cape Breton of Fall on Your Knees is not just a poverty-stricken Gaelic-speaking miners and fishermen. Something for everyone or for the reader who has to have everything.
Oh, that was like facing the firing squad of Natalie Sinclair's passion right there. All right, Nick. Nicholas Beauchart, last, representing Nikolsky by Nicholas Dickner. Go ahead, Nick.
Nikolsky, I think, has something that all these other books don't, which is a sort of visceral aliveness to it. It's an exciting book. It contains mystery. It has a city, it has the country, it has a tent, it has digging and biking and everything you could possibly want out of a book. Yes, digging. You wouldn't think that could be interesting. Nicholas Dickner's prose makes it so. It's a beautiful book and a great read.
All right. Only really one bell noise, and that was superfluous. I think that my panelists are trying to protect me from something, kind-hearted souls that they are. So Nick just brought up Nicholas Dickner's prose, and certainly that's something that we consider when we're looking for the book that all of Canada should read. Canada is well known internationally for its fiction, and a lot of that fiction comes from the classic poet-turned-author, the Anne Michaels or the Andache or the Margaret Atwood, and that kind of prose is highly praised, also sometimes criticized if it's somewhat impenetrable. So basically what we want to talk about now is the actual word craft involved in these books. So let's try and identify who we think is the best wordsmith out of the group. And I'm going to start with Nick.
Well, I'm going to surprisingly say that Nicholas Dickner, I would like to take out of the running for this competition because he's translated from French, and I haven't read the French, so I don't think I can fairly say if he's a great wordsmith.
We can operate on the Lazar Letterhender translation.
Because it is excellent. I wouldn't say it's particularly... It's all in the pacing with this book. It's not that the language he specifically uses is particularly beautiful, but the way he uses it is very rollicking and mysterious, and all the things that make up Nikolsky are reflected well in the book. But I would say probably the best wordsmith. I mean, they all bring something incredibly different to the table. Like, Waste and Troy is very slow and calculated and slow and slow and slow.
Aaron's rolling up her sleeve. Yeah. Let that be known.
Whereas, I mean, Marina Endicott is good at, you know, she puts the sentence together well. It happens, and she tells a story. It just happens that she keeps telling that story for a long time.
Grammatically correct.
yeah, exactly. But it's good. I find in a lot of books that you will find that, you know, the sentences can get confused or irrelevant, but it is concise. Like, what's happening is what's happening. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But, none of them are bad writers, is what I'm saying. They each have their own style.
Well, that's very conciliatory. Okay, Sarah's dying to go.
Well, I agree with Nick, and I think that I'm really invested in this question because I think that the importance of prose is, like, the reason we read. And I feel like literature is art. This question is going to be different for all of us. Like, the way that the joy in reading a book comes from the way that you respond to it, and it's a personal relationship that comes with a book. That being said, I have an anecdote. When I was in grad school, I was reading some insufferable theorist, and one of my classmates said, you know, do we have to be ironic all the time? We always have to be buried under this layer of irony? And for me, I felt like Nikolsky was a really well-written book, and I really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. But the tone that came from that first The Nameless Bookshop Owner protagonist, I just felt like I remember thinking to myself, if the rest of this book is going to continue on in this fashion, I'm not reading it. Because I was affronted by the tone. I just...
Very interesting.
You know, like, the prose can complement the book, but it can also inhibit.
Okay, so thumbs down for Nicholas Dickner or Lazar Letterhender in terms of... Nick was trying to get a stay of execution on this question, I think, by, like, slip under the radar, but we're not going to pull it out.
Narratives, and I've loved more ornamental narratives, but a pared-down narrative style can still be very poetic. It just allows the reader to engage with the story in a different way, in a more direct way, to focus on the experiences of the characters, for example, as opposed to their own experience with the words. I think the problem lies in when you have the extreme, so where poesy or its lack thereof is the ultimate end. So, you know, like my inner crotchety formalist, you know, demands that, you know, style serve the story. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why I loved Fall on Your Knees as much as I did, because MacDonald is spare, where it's important for the reader to really connect with the story. I've mentioned that first chapter, Silent Pictures, as a great example. And she's also at her most poetic and her most kind of ambiguous, where the reader needs to invoke their own personal experiences to understand understand those beautiful or horrifying moments that would become banal if MacDonald were to try to describe them more directly.
That's true. Okay. Erin?
I just think this is a great question because it's all about balance. And at what point is the plot servicing the reader? And at what point is the prose servicing the reader and servicing the author for the objective of the book? And if it's doing it a service, then it's working. But at the same time, like how Sarah was talking about how the prose in Nikolsky sometimes put her off. So it's just, yeah, I'm not being very articulate, but I think it's all about balance and servicing the reader. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with James Patterson. He's doing what he's doing. He's servicing an audience. That audience is responding to it. And so, yes, he's not the most literary or poetic person, but he has found a prose and a plot balance that works for him as an author.
Okay.
And I think that's important to remember for all authors.
I feel like I really connected with what you said about the prose and the plot serving the reader, but I feel like maybe the balance is found when the prose and the plot serve each other. And that mm-hmm. is one of the reasons why I felt like Marina Endicott was a really great storyteller, because Good to a Fault is really true to itself. It can't be anything but what it is. It gets flack for being boring and without action, but it couldn't expose the reader the way that it does, which for me is its hugest selling point, the implication of the reader. It couldn't do that if it were any other kind of book. Like, you wouldn't put a rocket engine on a bicycle. Like, the vehicle has to be appropriate to the message. And I feel like that balance is achieved really well in Good to a Fault.
Okay, now we're going to give Ashley a chance to weigh in, especially considering the author she's representing here has a very distinct style apart from all the other authors in this room, or all the other books in this room, and most authors, in fact, in the Canadian literature as a whole. So what do you think, Ashley?
Well, yeah, I think right away the title, he helped coin a term that people still use today. And throughout the novel, I think it's so interesting that Copeland creates his own language, and it's shown in the glossary in the margins of the entire book. I think that some of the words that he creates end up evoking the ideas so much better than if they were just embedded in the plot. Like when he discusses short-term nostalgia and McJob, I just think that those ideas come across so well through his own words that he chooses.
That's true. Copeland, in a sense, made up some of his own lexicon for the book itself. So yeah, that's really wordcraft to an extreme. Natalie has something to say.
And one of the things I really enjoyed was actually the way Copeland almost aspires to a kind of allegory with the stories that his protagonists are telling. I mean, that is how they articulate their own concerns and their own feelings. They don't talk about them directly. They can't. They're not as self-aware. It's not that they're not self-aware. They're alienated from that traditional lexicon, so they have to find another way to express themselves. So I think Generation X is an example of how a spare narrative can still be poetic, because allegory is a fantastic mode of writing, and it's very, very little used nowadays. It really is. It's more often, you know, it's easier to find in like you know, 13th and 14th century, you know, like Italian poetry, you know, Dante, for example. So
if we were doing, you know, Italy reads, we could bring back allegory.
Exactly.
So am I the only one who didn't go to grad school here?
Erin brought up the James Patterson, the plot-driven kind of novel. And everyone is kind of saying that you do want a novel that has a story that's going to carry us on, that's going to make us keep reading that 20 pages and beyond. So the next question that we're going to get into is, if we set aside the language, which we just discussed, and we're just talking about the page-turner potential of these books, which honestly is what a lot of people are going to be looking for in a Canada Reads title, which book has the greatest potential to be a page-turner? Ashley?
Well, to go to my own, Generation X, I think that what's so interesting about it is, in the tradition of, like, the Canterbury Tales or the Decameron, it's not one overarching plot. Like Natalie was talking about the allegory and all of the characters. Like, it wasn't about the story of Generation X, it was about the stories that they told each other. And I think that there's one of those stories is bound to resonate with you, and it's nice, digestible, short pieces that are a great read.
Okay.
Right, I guess I'm going to go with my book here now, not because it's just like packed with action. As Nick said, it is a very slow moving book, but he does such a good job with playing with what's going to happen now. And there's very subtle foreshadowing that you're there, and you're like, okay, this relationship they're developing, I know it's going to end terribly, and I need to know how it's going to happen and how it's going to come about. And with each of the three sections in the book. And so, yeah.
Okay, impending dread, which will suit us well for our next panelists, I think. That sense that all is going to go to hell. Mm-hmm. Sarah?
Absolutely how I felt about Good to a Fault. Impending doom. This is all going to come crashing down, and I have to know how that's going to happen. As Natalie said earlier, she said, I finished this book not because of the competition, but because I needed to know how this was all going to shake out. Even if it is a bit of a slow burn, even if it is, you know, as Nick said, the same things sort of happening over and over again, that's how we get involved. that's how we're implicated, by becoming a part of Clara's life. So I feel like it was really compelling in a really different way than I have experienced before. Also, shout out to Fall on Your Knees on this one, because that book absolutely got me. I remember the first time I read it, and it just, I could not put it down. It was so compelling, and it was just, and I think it was because I was so emotionally involved.
Okay. And from Fall on Your Knees, from Natalie?
I have to say Anne-Marie MacDonald is the best storyteller of the lot. Like, as you mentioned, how she said at the Toronto Public Library, everything is given away, but nothing is. You know, they're all dead now. You know right from the get-go that this is what has happened to these characters. But this is what's interesting is the journey. It's finding out how the characters got there. And that is what keeps you moving. If you put together the clues. And, you know, I gotta say, I became so attached to characters and what was happening to them in this book that I actually resorted to something I never do, and that's peeking at pages later in the chapter.
Oh,
because I thought, oh my god, like, I won't say which chapters because, you know, suffice it to because, you know, I really don't want to spoil
anymore.
But, suffice it to say, my heart was in my throat, like, my pulse is starting to race, and I'm thinking, oh my god, she better not do this, and not Anne-Marie MacDonald, but the characters, I'm not involved, where it's, oh my gosh, I can't believe her, I can't believe she'd do that.
And then they do it.
Yeah. And you keep reading, and yeah, it was an incredible ride.
All right, yeah. So roller coaster rides and slow burns,
so
Nick.
Obvious.
Well, I'm going to be the only non-self-centered.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. I was going to have to throw down some requirements, something for
I
next
think
round.
Maybe we should talk about all the books. I don't know, guys.
No.
Nice. Nicole's great, but Fall on Your Knees. Really, when I read it, I was really enthralled, and I was actually living on a boat at the time on the West Coast, and I was tree planting, so a lot of the. You know, being by the ocean, it being really crappy and damp all the time resonated with me. But aside from that, just like the language she uses and the way she sets up the story, it's really excellent. And it's definitely a page turner. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Ashley has something to say.
Yeah, I have to go back and say, to compliment anyone else on this, it's Fall on Your Knees, just the story. Because if you were to look at the actual plot, it's not anything that I would have found compelling myself. And it was even when we were talking about which ones we were resistant to read, like the words Family Saga, East Coast, it just was such a turnoff to me. But as soon as I started reading it, she just had such a way of creating that plot and creating those characters in such a fantastic way.
Excellent. So that discussion aside, we're going to move forward. And yesterday we talked about beginnings. We talked about the first 20 pages of a book. And I'd just like to take a moment to talk about endings, because literally, endings are the last impression that we have on the book. Some people like an ending that's all tied up. Some people like that who knows, inconclusive ending. And often it's about which ending serves the book best, as you've been saying. So taking that into consideration, that we're going to discuss which book has the best ending. Nick.
Well, first of all, I'm going to go into which book has the worst ending.
All right, that's fair.
I don't think that was
so.
That
Sarah, yeah, but you know, we're freeform.
Yeah.
Fine. Sarah's been constantly talking about how Good to a Fault makes the reader implicit in the book, and I really feel that the end, how everything just comes together, sort of, you get, yeah, you're implicit in the book, and you're drawn into a character, and blah, 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 but then everything's okay in the end. It completely forgives everything that happened in the whole book. It just writes it off.
I didn't hate A Good to a Fault as much as Nick did. What bothered me the entire time I was reading it is that there's no way she can end this book without going hokey. There's absolutely no way. And I don't think she did. I was just like, ugh, of course.
Natalie?
Like,
see, I think the ending is actually deceptively simple. I think there's actually more to it than there. I mean, Clara.
Natalie's gonna get another hug.
Well, she understands that, you know, she probably in many ways used them as much as she was used by them. And understanding this and she's still willing to enter into this, to allow herself to be used and to use them, and as much as she is useful. And I think it's extremely complex, and it's not as necessarily as hokey as it necessarily seems on the surface. And yeah, I did have a feeling that I was kind of like, oh, come on. But at the same time, I think it did. The character was true to her. The characters were true to themselves. As Sarah said, the book was true to itself as a whole, even.
Okay.
But it happens in 5 pages. It's like,
fair enough. Right. So,
I can move on to a good ending.
Can I rebut?
You can rebut.
Because it is my title. I'm emotionally attached. It doesn't really end. Like, it's just, I feel like the ending of Good to a Fault for me was more symbolic, and it was more like about going on, about moving forward, and about possibility, and about the idea that maybe we can just get over our shit. Maybe we can learn from our mistakes. Maybe this is possible. So.
Oh, Natalie has raised one thing.
But Clara doesn't really learn from her mistakes. She kind of acknowledges it. And, you know, Clayton... okay, sorry, spoiler. So if you don't want to hear it, pause now or go forward. But, I mean, Clayton is going to take off again and leave the family there. And Lorraine is still recovering. So Endicott resets the table, essentially, for things to happen again.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
Yes, Clara has this new knowledge, but the implication is that she's going to enter into that same sort of scenario again, willingly. She's really
beginning the whole book. Exactly.
She's sadistic. You know,
we're gonna cut Sarah a break at this moment, and we're gonna, Nick, there must have been an ending that you liked in there.
Well, coming back to Fall on Your Knees, I thought it was an excellent ending. It sort of ends before it begins, like we were saying before, and it really, it's a very complete narrative, and it pays off in the end. It doesn't really cut any corners or pull any punches. At the same time, I like the ending of Nikolsky because it is sort of, it's a real thinker. You gotta sit down with it a little bit. I still couldn't tell you really what happened in the end, but I like that. That's the whole book, is like the way, especially the way the two main characters just don't meet.
Yeah.
And it's to sort of come back to the pirate theme of Nikolsky. They're like two ships passing in the night.
Oh, we're getting away. Okay.
Anyway.
Natalie.
Yeah, Nikolsky, for all its fantastical nature, like any really great fairy tale, there's that truth, you know, that trueness to life. And that, I think, is what that really comes across in that ending. You don't have everything where, you don't have it where everything is neatly tied up in a bow. You know, it is very open-ended, and it leaves that possibility for more. That being said, I also really, really liked the way Wace and Choi ended each of the 3 sections of the Jade Peony, because I can't just speak to, like, the last, you know, 20 pages of the Jade Peony, but to each of those 3, they're almost like novellas. It is the slow burn, and you become very attached to these characters through the way he details the everyday and the way he makes these little moments in their life significant, and then the big payoff comes at the end, and you know, and it comes back, and you think, okay, so all these little things where you were forming bonds and all these little things that happened before become significant in these final moments, and it just leave you. It's like a punch to the gut, each of those endings. Like, for me, I close them thinking, oh my gosh. Especially the very last page where you think, and then it ends. And you just...
Breathless. Yeah. Natalie has been left breathless. Erin, what do you have to say?
No, I just completely agree with Natalie, and I just love that how he left it so unresolved, and each one so open-ended. So you're left thinking, what happened to these characters? How did they react to these things that totally impacted your lives? Because you're sitting there thinking that it's a huge moment for them, but then, you know, Leanne was 5, and Sek Lung was, like, 6 when these things happened, and so you're just left compelled and wanting to know more and thinking about more, and since he doesn't resolve any of it or give you any hints, you just really want more of it.
But for someone that wasn't into those characters, to have that kind of unresolved and just to be left hanging, I just found it to be even worse when you weren't even drawn in and you weren't thinking about them afterwards. And J.P. and he's gotten by with no scratches yet, so it needs to dig like that right now.
I think that... in response to that, I'm also going to send some love to the J.P. and he, because this is my favorite ending of any of the books, because I wasn't crazy about the first story, about Liang's story, but by the time I got to the end of the book, I was totally convinced. About halfway through, I said, I hate this book, and by the end, I said, I didn't hate this book. But I feel
like yes, it's going like to sell.
That's the tagline for the book.
I agree. Like, this
book. I don't hate it.
I feel like it really grew on me, and I feel like the unresolved ending speaks to more than just the characters themselves and their experiences, but also to the, sort of the some of the wider themes in
exactly.
the book. And I feel like the way it ended with the botched abortion attempt. Spoiler, sorry everybody. really, I mean, because it would have been sort of an interracial baby, it sort of, I feel like it bridged some of the void between new and old, but also showed where there are stops, things, it showed what isn't possible, what can be and what can't be. So I...
The big symbolic punch.
The big symbolic punch.
All right, fair enough. Luckily, the JPNE got a little talk time towards the end, or we might have had to call it out, but we could leave that for tomorrow, should it survive the vote, because, ladies and gentlemen, it is voting time. Each of our panelists have a piece of paper where they will write the name of the book which they would like to see eliminated from the competition. And... that is where we are going to leave off this podcast for today. Cliffhanger! So tune in tomorrow and find out which book the civilians decided to get rid of first. I'm Jen Nock, and this is Civilians Read 2010, episode number 2.